Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, October 23rd, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Washington Bureau Chief from The Intercept, Ryan Grimm, will be here. Also, later in the program, comedian Tim Heidecker will join us. And the filmmakers of a documentary out called Man Card. Meanwhile, a sedate but at times incoherent Donald Trump fails in the final debate. Negotiations on the stimulus continue, but McConnell's dream of leaving Americans in the lurch looks to be fulfilled. And signs point to a massive Democratic early vote lead. So the Republicans head to the Supreme Court to make mail-in voting harder. COVID spikes as the nation sees its second highest, or I should say its highest daily total. U.S. signs an international anti-abortion declaration. Minnesota and Michigan Senate races tighten. Worry Democrats. A Republican House candidate in Georgia attacks a reporter for working for, quote, non-white males, for, quote, aiming to ruin white males. And lastly, the Trump campaign is surveilling Philadelphia voters in what looks like an intimidation or perhaps an invalidation scheme. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, folks. It is Casual Friday. As you can see, I'm wearing a soft-collared shirt today. We are now just about 10 days away from the election. A week from Tuesday is the, well, it's the final day in which you can vote. And so it's not, we already have record number of votes that have already come in and in various states around the country. And last night, the debate, obviously, I'm not sure what the numbers are in terms of how many people saw it, but I think to the extent that people did see it, I don't anticipate it's going to change the dynamics of the race too much. I think it probably helped Biden. We're going to be talking with Ryan Grimm about that. But one of the things that the that Donald Trump attempted to do last night that I don't feel like it was terribly successful, but we will see in the next couple of days, is to get the American public interested in emails that are purportedly from Hunter Biden. I don't know what it is they think about emails have such an allure, but these Donald Trump spent an inordinate amount of time talking about Hunter Biden's emails. There is a tweet this morning from a reporter from Fox News that I think it's very hard to assess what's going on here because apparently there was a press conference yesterday by this guy Tody Bubulinski, and who is a was a business partner of Hunter Biden's. as well as, I guess, also having worked for in the adult matching industry. More on that as that develops. But he, this Bob Linsky, gave a press conference where he said, "I'm not going to go into the evidence I have of the allegations that Joe Biden was involved in our business deals, but they're here on three phones." And he showed the three phones, and then he walked off with them. And the emails that are purportedly from Hunter Biden remain only in PDF form and have not been, you know, widely distributed. But in this instance, we have a reporter. Can you put that up, Brendan? It is from Jackie Heinrich. And what she wrote was, "I completed searching all of Tony Bobulinski's emails." I guess this is these are the ones that that Hunter Biden participated on. And they established that the chairman, apparently, supposedly, Hunter Biden would refer to his father in code as the chairman. They established that, one, the chairman is actually China. There is no role for Joe Biden in the emails and documents. And Bobulinski states himself, there are no other members besides Hunter Biden, Jim Biden, Rob Walker, James Giller, and Bobulinski himself. Now, this Jackie Heinrich is a national correspondent for Fox News covering the 2020. She is a 3-time award-winning, Emmy award-winning reporter, host for the Fox News Rundown. I can't say I am familiar with her work, but I suspect that that she's not looking to simply run interference for Joe Biden, at least as a career move over at Fox News. So I don't know what to make of that, but I'll tell you who would be really upset to hear all of this is Don Jr., who after the debate last night on Sean Hannity's program was very agitated about these Hunter Biden emails or laptops. Or here's Don Jr.
Russian disinformation. There's literally zero evidence of that. It's Russian disinformation. The director of national intelligence said it. And by the way, more importantly, the FBI said it. And I don't say that because I think the FBI has more credibility. I say that because it's pretty clear that the FBI has done whatever they possibly could to hurt Donald Trump. So if they're even coming out and saying this, meaning the upper levels of the FBI, the door kickers love us, not so much the bureaucrats at the top. But if even they're coming out and saying, yeah, there's absolutely no evidence, you know, and that doesn't prevent Adam Schiff and MSDNC from being out there and peddling this thing as though it's real Russia disinformation. It's
You've
been
got
corroborated.
Phones,
it's real.
Emails.
Joe Biden is corrupted and compromised, and America has to know it, Sean.
Wow. He had a lot of energy for that time.
Take
in that
a breath.
Wow. The door kickers love those guys, not the pencil pushing geeks, bureaucrats. You know, it's very odd that they waited this long to drop this stuff, because it's not exactly, I mean, it's not quite clear what the narrative that they're trying to push is, and they're not going to have time to develop it. And I'm not like, you know, this is, there's a lot of desperation, I think, there. There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that Joe Biden was involved in anything corrupt. I think it's quite obvious that Hunter Biden traded off of his family name. And yes, I think that's corruption in some form. And it's a corruption that permeates our society, as we hear Donald Trump Jr. I mean, how many stories have we had over the past 4 years of one of the Trump children, I don't know, getting their trademarks in China because of some deal, or closing deals, you know, Jared Kushner closing deals for financing for real estate projects. I mean, it's all, that is all corrupt. Joe Biden's son trading off of his name is not something that we should be excited about, but it doesn't have any bearing on Joe Biden necessarily. And there doesn't seem to be any evidence of that whatsoever. Apparently, the Fox News is reporting that the FBI is going to look at Bobulinski's phones for whatever evidence that they're looking for. But it is hard to imagine at this point that this is going to develop into anything one way or another. But I guess we'll see. It's also, you also have to wonder if this isn't something that a narrative that they're trying to build in the event that Trump loses. You know, usually these things are sort of win-win on both sides. They want to be able to run with something even if Trump loses. So, you know, Benghazi lasted for 3 or 4 years. They had a lot. That was very durable for them. All right. We're going to talk to Ryan Grimm in just a moment about this and other things. In the meantime, today's program is sponsored by Sunset Lake CBD. We've talked about them quite a bit. They are their farm up in outside of Burlington, Vermont. Started out as a dairy farm supplying milk for Ben and Jerry's ice cream. And then they diversified a little bit a couple years ago, started to harvest CBD. And they one of the things that they do is regenerative farming. And I was curious as to what it means. And basically what it means is that the soil is a living entity. And when you deplete it, you've got to regenerate it. And so it's an evolving term, but for commercial agriculture, it means creating healthier soil. And they do that by reducing and eliminating harmful pesticides, herbicides, fungicides. Their CBD is 100% pesticide free. They reduce or eliminate the use of outside chemical fertilizers. They reduce water usage, reduce and eliminate heavy tilling. Tilling, of course, is when you're digging up the soil a lot, turning it over. They implement cover cropping and seasonal crop rotations. So they don't abuse the soil, essentially. They'll switch their fields. And their CBD is fantastic. They have tinctures that I use to help me sleep. They have smokables. Matt, talk about the smokables for a moment. You're a bit of an expert. Matt, are you there? No, I don't know where he went. But Matt was a skeptic when it came to smokables and has been enjoying their pre-rolls and their smalls, I guess. That's his favorite. For me, it's the tincture and the salve with arnica. It's great for sore muscles. I use it for my eczema, but I don't know if it works for other people for that. It does for me. And my mic's dead?
You're fine.
Oh, okay. Matt's mic is dead. Sorry. I use the salve for my eczema, and they have gummy bears, and they have coffee infused with CBD. And you get 20% off using the coupon code Left Is Best. Left Is Best is the coupon code for SunsetLakeCBD.com. Check them out; you won't be disappointed. All right, let's welcome to the program the Washington Bureau Chief of The Intercept, Ryan Grimm. Ryan, did I get your title correct? Well, it's connecting right now. Hello, Ryan.
Well, hello.
Ryan, did I get your title correct? Are you the Washington Bureau Chief for The Intercept?
Yes, but can you instead say that I'm the host of The Intercept podcast, Deconstructed?
Yes, I can also say you're the host of the Intercept podcast.
You can skip the other one so I don't sound like royalty with like eight different titles.
All right. Well, then,
but it's up to you. I'm not here to tell you how to do your job. I'm just trying to get a plug for the podcast.
I appreciate that, Ryan. All right. So, all right. First off, I want to do this. Okay. I want to talk about the debate. I want to talk about what's going on in terms of the stimulus negotiations and what you think about what happened this week with the Amy Coney Barrett hearings and also just sort of the way that the Democrats have been playing it. But I want to do one of those like empty the note with the reporter notebook segments with you. Okay. Of questions that range here. There's a report out that Bernie Sanders is interested in being Joe Biden's labor secretary. Have you seen that in Politico?
Yeah.
Have you heard anything about that?
I haven't asked about it myself, but they haven't denied it. And so Holly's a good reporter. I suspect that's a trial. That's like a purposeful trial balloon.
Interesting. Okay. Fair enough. What have you heard about the Senate races in Minnesota and Michigan? They seem to be tightening. And there was a report that there's at least a significant amount of money going into Michigan. Have you heard anything about those?
No, other than the white working class voting registration numbers are, you know, concerning for Democrats. Both of those candidates are total duds. They're just your replacement level Democrats who, you know, will be kind of dragged over the finish line by Democratic energy if they win.
All right, fair enough.
But and most people can't even tell you who the Minnesota one is.
It's Tina.
I mean, most people can't tell you who I know, but most people can't tell you who either of them is.
Right.
Tina Smith has actively like resisted anyone getting to know her after replacing Al Franken.
Yeah, it does seem like these are very low-key senators. All right, another question, because you wrote a piece about two progressives, congressional candidates, who are actually getting support from the DCCC. And while progressive groups had stepped back, you wrote that a couple of weeks ago. I'm curious if you've heard anything in regards to Paula Jean Swearingen. This is actually a question from a listener. And Marquita Bradshaw. Bradshaw's running in Tennessee against Bill Hagerty. Swearingen's running against Shelley Moore Capito in West Virginia. I imagine there's not a lot of money going into the West Virginia race because there's just a presumption that she's not going to do well. I mean, I haven't seen much polling on frankly, either one of these races.
There was a really good story in The Nation that kind of profiled the Paula Jean race. But the polarization in partisan politics makes it so that you would have to have just an otherworldly kind of event. And that's like a Joe Manchin, you know, a guy who like people who used to be Democrats are willing to continue to vote for, even though he calls himself a Democrat because he attacks Democrats all the time. But outside of that, because you've got this Republicans vote for Republicans, Democrats vote for Democrats trend in American politics that she has almost an insurmountable obstacle. Like if you look at Richard Ojeda's race as kind of the,
he ran for Congress,
right? So, and he ran way out, well, all the way out in like Hinton, West Virginia, like far out mountains, in a district that Republicans usually win by 30. And I think he swung it like 20 points further, you know, in Democrats' direction, but he still lost, you know, comfortably. And he lost to the most out of touch country club Republican that you could imagine. Had, you know, she had everything going wrong for her. She was taking a ton of pharma money personally and in her campaign.
And people, West Virginia is one of the epicenters of the opioid overdose crisis.
And everyone's lives and all of these towns are just being destroyed by the opioid crisis, and you know, against her, you have this charismatic veteran who sparked and led the teacher strikes and, you know, who is raising a ton of money, is as West Virginia as you can come. His parents and grandparents worked in the mines. His father actually came illegally. The grandfather came illegally from Mexico and became a miner. in West Virginia, and he put down roots. That's why his name is Ojeda, but he says it with the hard J. And he still couldn't win.
Right.
And so if you don't have to win that district to win statewide, but you've got to make it a little bit closer than that. And so if he can't win against that opponent, it's like, oof.
It's all negative partisanship there. Yeah. And we remind people, you know, Joe Manchin made it to the Senate by taking, I think it was an AR-15, and shooting, and literally, yes, an ad shooting the, I can't remember what climate.
Cap and trade bill. Yeah.
Bill. And he
actually, you know what it was? It would have been Cary Graham Lieberman, right? Back when Lindsey Graham was cutting deals with Democrats all the time.
Right. So there's that. And so what about in Tennessee, where Marquita Bradshaw is running against Bill Hagerty?
She probably has a better chance than Paula Jean, just simply because negative partisanship doesn't punish you as much in Tennessee. It's still a massive uphill climb, but West Virginia is more Republican than Tennessee is at this point, particularly because Tennessee has the two things that make a state Democratic at this point, which are cities and suburbs,
right?
In enough of a proportion to make it competitive. And Tennessee is one of those interesting places where, you know, the countryside in America is evolving slowly or disappearing slowly and being replaced by developments, housing developments and suburban tracts of land. And so that changes the political construction of the local areas. And so the more suburban places become and the less kind of rural they become, then it used to be the more Republican. Now it's the more Democratic. And so as places like Tennessee continue to, you know, fall victim to sprawl, they're going to become more Democratic as long as this trend continues to hold.
We're seeing that in places like Georgia and North Carolina, right? I mean, that's really
And Texas, like everybody for 10 years was like, you know, the sleeping giant of the Hispanic vote. And when in fact, what happened is that the suburbs of all of these major cities just kept sprawling and sprawling and sprawling out. All of these companies came, you know, either set up shop there or came from California or New York and put their headquarters there to take advantage of the low housing prices, the lack of an income tax, all of the other, you know, policies that the Republican legislature put in place. And they brought with them all of their employees who are now voting Democratic. And the idea of states having their individual cultures is vanishing as well. You know, if you plop down in a suburb outside of Dallas or Houston, and then you plop down outside of Raleigh or Georgia or Nashville, you're going to find the same businesses, the same types of companies, the same specific chain stores, the same grocery stores, the same types of people who have the same kind of values and interests and relationship to American culture. So the sectionalism that dominated American politics for like two centuries is slipping away as these suburbs become more homogenous around the country.
That's fascinating. And I would imagine that, you know, these people are all coming from, you know, more or less from the same places across the country, mm-hmm, in terms of like, right, where they're moving to, from, I guess. It's,
right. They're spilling out of Jersey and New York and California and yeah.
All right. Well, so, okay. So let's get to the events this week. The debate last night, I mean, it had a marked feel of, I mean, the thing that has really, I found, maybe, I guess it's fairly obvious and it's not terribly surprising, but the Trump campaign has never been able to settle on an argument against Joe Biden. I mean, it's evolved from like Sleepy Joe. He's gone from Sleepy Joe to now like some type of kingpin, and in the course of like 3 weeks. And I think that's got to be confusing for voters. Like nothing is sticking to Biden because they haven't spent more than a couple of weeks on it.
And you left out what came in between Sleepy Joe and the corrupt kingpin was that he's actually a secret vanguard for the radical revolution.
That's right. I forgot.
So
he's Bernie Sanders in with a Joe Biden mask on.
But then also like cutting all these corrupt deals around the world, but also, you know, sleepy and lazy. So like they managed to find three different labels, all of which conflict with each other. Like you can't have a single one of those and have any of the others, unless maybe you could map the Sleepy Joe with like the radicals are going to crush him because, you know, he's too sleepy. He can't resist the energy of Bernie Sanders, but that's not what they're saying. They're saying that he's actually a crypto communist. And, you know, once he gets into office, he and Kamala, who Trump said last night is to the left of Bernie Sanders.
Wow.
Which, okay, interesting.
That's an interesting guy.
Good to know. She's been playing a real long game here, running from the right in all these elections.
Exactly. As a prosecutor as well. Yeah. I mean, it had struck me that, you know, that is one of the biggest differences that I think between the, obviously people know Donald Trump. He's not running as an unknown quantity on some level, but the idea that at least in terms of the Trump campaign, what they're trying to do, they have not been able to, there has not been a pre-existing narrative about Joe Biden that they can exploit. And right. On some level, like, you know, progressives, the narrative about Joe Biden was sort of the slate was sort of wiped clean a little bit during Obama because he laid, you know, he was just the vice president.
Right.
But prior to that, he was the senator from MBNA. And that seems to have like gone into the, you know, down the memory hole because for 8 years, he was just Barack Obama's vice president. And then people just assumed he wasn't ever going to run again.
Right. The Onion did him, you know, an incredible favor by turning him into this, you know, jean short wearing, you know, sunglass, you know, smile flashing, you know, car dude.
Right.
That is completely inoffensive to anybody. And you just kind of laugh at him. Like, look, good old Uncle Joe. And it also shows the kind of limitations of what the GOP's kind of slash and burn strategy can do. Like they needed 30 years to create the narrative around Hillary Clinton so that they could stick and she continuously, you know, fed into it
right.
time after time.
We should add part of that was also her gender helped them create right.
That certainly helped. You know, she couldn't be Uncle Hillary.
Right.
You know, and the fact that it's Uncle Joe is strongly gendered in itself, that the uncle holds a particular place in our society that the aunt doesn't. Anyway, we could go around a whole another bend on that one, but they never did the same thing with Joe Biden for good reason. I mean, they saw him run in 1988 and they saw him run in 2008 and there was no reason for them to think that this guy was a reasonable threat to take on the conservative project in any serious way or wind up in the White House except through some fluke. And here we are. And so if you haven't kind of paved the way for some type of a narrative, then it's difficult for it to stick because people don't pay close enough attention. So it costs you hundreds of millions of dollars to soften the ground, you know, successfully enough that you can turn someone like Hillary Clinton into somebody that has two out of three people saying that she's not trustworthy.
Right.
And like you said, you also need the gender dynamics with it as well.
And so based upon that, that sort of pre-existing calculus, it feels to me like Donald Trump failed in, I mean, look, Trump's strategy is at this point is really just to depress the turnout with Biden. And he seemed to try and do that in two different ways last night. Do the corruption angle, which was largely incoherent. I mean, there was talk mm-hmm. about Hunter and then things that like
the,
I'm sorry. Like
3.5 million from Russia or like.
Yes. Like, I'm sorry. There's no amount of investigation that people could do at this point to understand what he was saying. Like, even if you even people at Breitbart, I think, would have trouble sort of divining what Trump was trying to communicate there. And then the second thing was the whole super predator thing, which is aimed at trying to depress Biden's black turnout. And I think I don't know how that landed with people, but I think it's a hard sell. And I think, you know, Joe Biden articulated when he was articulating about the talk, I think it's quite clear to black folk that at the very least he knows black people enough to know about the talk and to know some of the details about it. And you know, it's hard to imagine that Trump moved the needle in that regard as well.
Yeah, and he even condemned his own approach to the crime bill, and straight up said that he was wrong about it. I think if you don't have the pandemic, then Trump's strategy makes sense. And if you don't have the pandemic, you might not have the upsurge in Black Lives Matter protests over the summer, which may have been linked to the rising anger that people felt at their general situation in life, as well as the particular crime of the murder of George Floyd. But as unemployment in the Black community was falling to historic lows, as wages were rising, and as Biden was not showing, a huge ability to kind of rouse the broader electorate, as long as the economy kept humming from January 2020 up through November, there's every reason to believe that that Trump's numbers across the board are enough better that we're looking at roughly a tie ball game going in here, and that's within the margin for Republicans to steal, either through their structural advantages, which isn't exactly stealing through the Electoral College and other things, or through their control of the courts and the voting system and the voter suppression laws that have been put into place. So I think without the pandemic, he'd be in the driver's seat right now. He's only down 10 after more than 200,000 people died and all of the other consequences of his misleadership.
Yeah, I know. I agree. I mean, I don't, it gets a little scary to contemplate. I'm not convinced necessarily that Biden would have necessarily been, the nominee. I mean, I think like it was more or less settled, when the pandemic hit, but it certainly changed. I think it pivoted the race very quickly in a way that it wouldn't have otherwise. But it is a little bit scary to contemplate a race between Joe Biden and Donald Trump that was based just merely on Joe Biden being a good guy.
Right.
Programmatic offering that was going to be substantially different than what Donald Trump was offering, because, I think at this point, Donald Trump being somewhat sociopathic. I mean, that it came across last night, the way he was just sort of sloughing off these deaths and saying, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. It could have been 2.5 million, and I don't get any credit for not killing more people. I think the fact is that if the economy is doing well, then people are like, all right, he's a jerk. And maybe hopefully he'll stop tweeting. I mean, that's basically what we heard, back in a year ago, let's say. It would have been a little bit nerve wracking, but it is.
And if you look at the moment when the polls started really dividing, it was early June. And to me, the moment everything fell apart for Trump was when he cleared the park out in front of the White House using tear gas so that he could hump across it with his generals to like wave the Bible around in front of that church. He has not recovered from that moment. That was a time where something finally stuck to him, and you started to see the 6-7-8 point gap open up. And without the, for obviously without Black Lives Matter protests taking over the country at that time, that wouldn't have happened, period. But the protests all also pulled from him his deepest bigotry. And that bigotry made it, you know, being so on display made it really hard for him to try to kind of solidify some of the genuine gains that he had made with the black vote to that point. And so he's also back to where he was.
It also revoked a license, I think, for some suburban college voters who would have been who needed some type of plausible deniability as to who Trump was. I mean, they tried. I mean, you can look at the RNC and see what they tried to do there, right? Look, I'm on stage, or, you know, not on stage, but here's a video of me naturalizing some citizens, and here's a video of me pardoning a black man. And so, now you have a license to vote for me because everything they're saying about me is wrong, and you're not a bad person if you vote for me. But that seems to be out by the wayside. We should say there's still different opportunities for the Republicans. I think it's highly unlikely that Donald Trump is going to get more votes than Joe Biden. He may in some states, or there may be large swaths of votes that through legalistic means are discounted. So we should say that this is not a foregone conclusion. We're just talking about sort of like more or less the political dynamics there. All right. So let's pivot here and talk about the other politics that are going on. There are two major things that are happening right now or not happening. One is the stimulus fight. So at the last I heard, Nancy Pelosi said that she thinks that they may come to an agreement, her and Mnuchin, but they won't vote on it until after the election. In what possible world do if Joe Biden wins and the Democrats take the Senate, or Joe Biden wins and the Democrats don't take the Senate, is this going to get passed? I mean, Mitch McConnell, the moment Joe Biden wins the election, Mitch McConnell goes into everything stops mode. I don't let the country burn mode. How is it possible that they could pass something after the election unless Donald Trump wins and Mitch McConnell's the Senate majority leader, and then they're going to pass their bill, essentially. And it's going to look a lot like the CARES Act, I would imagine, on some level. Why doesn't Nancy Pelosi take the 1.8 or even the 2 trillion and force Mitch McConnell to force his senators to vote on that? Because that puts Mitch McConnell in a very bad position, and the Republicans in the Senate in a very bad position. And one way or another, if Joe Biden wins, there's going to have to be some measure of relief before February 1st, which is the earliest it will come if the Democrats take the Senate and the House and the presidency.
You know, we don't exactly know why Pelosi won't do this. I mean, we know what she has said, in that disastrous interview with Wolf Blitzer. She suggested that she was trying to deprive Trump of being able to send checks with his name out on them. But, you know, people close to her say that that's not exactly what she meant, but she won't share with people, you know, what precisely is in the package. And so Democrats in the House say, we can't quite agree to this because what if there is, infinite liability protection for negligent businesses stuffed in there, a complete destruction of any plaintiff's rights in exchange for 2 months of stimulus. We don't, that wouldn't be a fair trade-off, but they have to talk in these hypotheticals because nobody basically outside of Pelosi and Mnuchin know what the actual details of this package are. Now, Pelosi has told Democrats privately that she very much does want to get some type of a deal through, if only to reduce the price tag of what Biden has to get through when he comes in January or February. And I think that that's perfectly sound logic. You know, if you don't do $2 trillion now, then the additional $2 trillion that Biden needs in January is now $4 trillion.
Right.
And everyone in Washington will say $4 trillion. You can't do $4 trillion. Yet those same people, if you did two now and you did two in February, would say, well, this is what people are demanding. And this is what economists say is needed. You put that together and it will create, you know, political problems. And Pelosi recognizes that. Yet at the same time, here we are, like, not with it not happening.
Is it possible? Is it possible that she thinks that this is going to help Trump that much? Because I don't see how it could help. I mean, if they pass something today, nobody's going to see those checks with Donald Trump's name on it until November, you know, after November 3rd anyways. And
the only other thing you could think is that she's worried that just the news going around, Trump and Democrats reach, you know, stimulus deal of $2 trillion, like that news would send a signal to people around the country that Trump's a reasonable person. And
but they did that 8 months ago.
I know. They've done it three times already.
It hasn't helped.
Right.
Donald Trump. And in this situation,
you have to really reach.
It would put Mitch McConnell in a very, very bad position.
Right.
Right. I mean, because.
Right. He would probably spike it. Right.
He would spike it. And then every Senate race around the country would be like, you need to, you know, Tina Smith would have to say to her opponent, like, are you really going to support the guy who just canceled all the stimulus for people? Are you going to vote with Mitch McConnell? I mean, that if I was running for the Senate, this would be like, this is exactly what I need to win the race. Right. It just seems extraordinary to me. And then simultaneously on the Senate side, in terms of the Democratic leadership, you have Chuck Schumer. I don't know what he does as a leader, but we had Dianne Feinstein go in there. They did these hearings after saying they were a sham, and Amy Coney Barrett comes out the other end doing better with Democrats and independents than she did going in.
Significantly.
And Jamie Harrison, I mean, I don't know if he lost any ground because, Dianne Feinstein basically said Lindsey Graham is, you know, they cut that into an ad and basically said Lindsey Graham's the old Lindsey Graham. He's not in Donald Trump's pocket anymore. Here's Dianne Feinstein praising him. I mean, this was a disaster, it seems. And then they finally boycott the vote after they had already participated in the entire process. It's completely incomprehensible.
Yeah, Feinstein should have boycotted the whole thing.
Yes.
She should boycott the Senate, period. Democrats would probably be a lot better off. You know, it's awfully hard to teach these old dogs new tricks. Feinstein's been at this game for, what, 60 years or so? And, you know, as she told those 8-year-olds from the Sunrise Movement, you don't tell me how to do my job. I've been doing this for 60 years. I know what I'm doing. And she is strongly convinced of that. And she's clearly surrounded by people who have, you know, helped her believe that that's true. The fact that it's sad, but the fact that Schumer was able to get them to even just boycott the vote was actually a big step forward in a kind of Senate Democratic caucus politics. That's how much room they have to make up. Like, that's how far behind they are. That counted as a kind of significant tactical organizing victory, that they were finally able to do that. But it required them utterly humiliating themselves on a national scale in order to get through to people that, no, like, what you're doing is backfiring. It's bad for the country and it's bad for Democrats, and it's also bad for our Senate races. like you said, well, you're out here cutting ads for Lindsey Graham on a national platform.
So how much, if I hear you correctly, it's like they got their failure was significant enough that it convinced them that we have to do something slightly different.
Yeah.
How durable is that awareness? Because, I mean, I just found the whole thing to be a shocking failure. Amy Coney Barrett is the most possibly radical Supreme Court nominee we've ever seen. Like mm-hmm. the idea that she sat as a trustee on the board of a school 5 years ago that basically said, if your parents are gay, you can't come here. And if you're LGBTQ, you cannot teach here. The fact that she signed a public ad, you know, calling for the criminalization of abortion. I mean, this is extreme. And the idea that she comes out with a better rating than she went in terms of Democrats and independents even, is, I don't understand. Like, it doesn't feel like anybody there is doing any politics.
Yeah. They also went in with the assumption that they were going to lose and that the best thing for them to do would be to kind of lose quickly and quietly. And so that was their goal, and they set about achieving it. And so, you know, their lodestar is taking back the Senate. And so they also think that disruption hurts Democratic candidates. Like they don't have a reason exactly for that, but that's a belief of theirs that they think they think back to Kavanaugh, and they think that, you know, if it weren't for all these protesters and if it weren't for this contentious battle over Kavanaugh, then, you know, Claire McCaskill and Joe Donnelly, they do better. Maybe they don't win, but they do better in their races. They don't think about the fact that John Tester won in Montana despite opposing Kavanaugh basically out of the gate the entire way.
2018 was right. A record-breaking Democratic victory, right? They had more votes in 2018 than in any off-year election in the history. If there wasn't gerrymandering, they would have like 1970s level Democratic majority in the House at this point.
But what they took from that was that Claire McCaskill and Joe Donnelly lost. And so therefore, and they blame the loss on Kavanaugh. And so that it, to get in their minds, that's where they are. It's like, oh God, another Supreme Court nominee. Let's hush up and get through this.
Couldn't they have figured out? I mean, that's what the boycotting the whole thing would have been a much better strategy, because then it's not about Amy Coney Barrett at all.
Right.
It's about the process. And they could have just flagged, here's the Republicans acting. I mean, you're still not going to win, but you're going to gain something. You're going to make the Republicans pay a political cost. And we talked about narratives at the beginning of this conversation. The narrative that the Republicans are breaking norms right now is one that could stick and is the one that they should have, that the Democrats wouldn't have had to do any heavy lifting to promote that one. It is, I mean, whose failure is that? Is there anybody that we can look to and say, this is a failure of leadership in the Democratic, in the Senate? I mean, because it feels to me like Chuck Schumer treats the other senators like they're his constituents, mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, like, what can I do for you today? How can I make this easy on you today? As opposed to actually using the leadership to make a coherent message and to do things politically.
Yeah, just like Chuck wants and deserves whatever credit he gets for if they do take back the Senate, he deserves the blame for you know, whatever failure. So it really is Chuck, and you're exactly right. Like, and I don't even think he or his people would necessarily disagree with your characterization of how he sees his job. And that's different than how Harry Reid saw his job. Reid absolutely catered to his members. He, you know, knew all of their phone numbers, was calling them all constantly. He had a kind of innate feel for precisely what it was that they needed back in their state and what would hurt them and benefit them politically, and worked to ease that for them. So, you know, he did that, but at the same time, he felt like his job was to be the Senate leader, and that when he needed people to get in line behind a strategy, he would get them in line behind that strategy, which is harder to do in the Senate than it is in the House. You know, the House is a more parliamentarian place where it's more top down. You know, you have people like the Squad who get out of line every now and then, but they don't even get out of line that often. Whereas in the Senate, you know, these people see themselves as independent power centers in a way that they don't over in the House. Reid did a much better job at corralling them because he saw his job as doing that. Whereas, like you said, Schumer sees his job as defending and catering to each and every one of them, with the hope that at some point, eventually, that type of catering leads to them there being enough of those individuals in the Senate that he is Senate Majority Leader, rather than thinking like, well, how do we organize into a cohesive block of people who can execute on a strategy?
It'll just come together on its own. And of course, what it also does, and I think this is also, I think, you know, there's a theory out there that Nancy Pelosi, I think it was David Dayen, wrote something to this effect, that Nancy Pelosi's out there. And I think she said this on one interview with Jake Tapper. I'm listening to my committee chairs. And so when it comes to cutting the silos of interest that those committee chairs represent, and they could be perfectly valid interests, right? I'm the chair of the Education Committee. Mm-hmm. I want to money for education. Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to leave any of those aside in this round of stimulus because it's about maintaining her power as a potential Speaker of the House. And Chuck Schumer, when he is this, asks nothing of his members, but only provides them with services. It's about maintaining his power as Senate Minority Leader and maybe Majority Leader. But at the end of the day, it's rank and file Democrats who are frustrated with what happens, and it's much harder to sort of like make it clear what's going on. Is there any, and we just have a minute here, but is there any frustration amongst the senators that you ever hear about here on the Hill to that effect, or are they just, I've got a concierge, why should I have a problem with it?
There is some among the ones, you know, who have more ambition ideologically for what the Senate ought to achieve, but at the same time, there's no real viable challenger at this point. You know, people kick around every now and then that maybe John Tester would be an interesting leader, but there's nobody that could challenge him at this moment. The most hopeful thing for the left is the fact that Schumer is up for re-election in 2022, and is keen on avoiding a primary challenge from his left, a serious primary challenge from his left. And so if the Senate Democrats are seen to be weak and stumbling, then he knows that he'll be blamed for that. And that could draw a primary challenge. So there's a very good chance that in the first year, he'll be like a Chuck Schumer, like you haven't seen before.
Well, hope springs eternal. Ryan Grimm from The Intercept and the what's the name of the podcast again?
Deconstructed.
Constructed.
Deconstructed. Podcast. It was Mehdi Hassan's podcast, but he abandoned us for that Peacock network.
Yes, in fact, we are playing on the Peacock network ourselves.
Hello, Peacock viewers.
Indeed. There
you go. We had him on last night, actually, for our podcast that we published this morning, Mehdi.
Oh,
well, and I screwed up. I should have called the podcast Return of the Medi, but I did not.
You missed an opportunity. Ryan Grimm, always a pleasure.
See you later.
Bye-bye. All right, quick break. We'll be right back. So we were talking about Donald Trump in his performance in the debate last night, and it was wildly incoherent. And it's the difficulty that Donald Trump has when he tries to define Joe Biden now. And he was Ryan Grimm pointed out this is the third iteration of the definition of Joe Biden for Donald Trump, going from Sleepy Joe to actually seriously radical Joe, secretly radical Joe, to now, crime kingpin Joe, all in the span of literally several weeks. Joe Biden has been very, very consistent in his pitch to the American public. And that's basically just, I'm a decent guy. And here he is making that point last night.
You now, you're a politician. I ran because of you.
All right, Vice President Biden, your response to that, and then I do have some questions for both of you.
Well, I tell you what, I hope he does look at me, because what's happening here is, you know who I am, you know who he is, you know his character, you know my character, you know our reputations for honor and telling the truth. I am anxious to have this race. I am anxious to see this take place. I am, the character of the country is on the ballot. Our character is on the ballot. Look at us closely.
Let me ask some follow-up.
Excuse me.
Please respond, and then we're going to have follow-up questions.
If this stuff is true about Russia, Ukraine, China, other countries, Iraq, if this is true, then he's a corrupt politician.
All right.
So don't give me the stuff about how you're this innocent baby. Joe, they're calling you a corrupt politician.
Well, and again, you know, the problem is that Donald Trump has gone from you know, saying it was Sleepy Joe, who can barely make his way up onto the debate stage, to now he's a crime kingpin who's involved in half a dozen countries around the world.
Yeah, stop saying you're sleepy like a baby.
Exactly. And that's the problem that the Trump campaign has had, is that they have not been able to settle on a narrative. Because, again, Trump's play here is to depress Democratic turnout. And he cannot come up with a narrative that will stick to Joe Biden. At one point last night, as they were going back and forth on each other's families, you know, Donald Trump was going in about Hunter Biden, and then Biden was talking about, well, I mean, we've been reading about your family business for 4 years. And at one point, Biden turned to the audience and said, this is about their families. And, you know, for people who watch politics, I think as much as a lot of us do around here, that kind of stuff is, you know, pretty standard fare. But we have not seen stuff like that for years. And I when I was watching that, stuff that would have made me feel sort of more jaded about it, you know, even during the primary, which we just didn't see it because it was quite clear that everybody was making a pitch about people's families. I couldn't help but think, like, I bet you there's a lot of people out there who are pretty excited about a fairly banal politician who is making a pitch that he or she, but it's he in this case, is running to help your family. I have a feeling that during a time of a pandemic, during a time of a presidency where the guy is constantly talking about himself and how everything affects Trump, I have a feeling that probably resonated. And Joe Biden did see slight bump in the poll, you know, the flash poll afterwards. Certainly all the polls had him, the snap polls had him winning the debate. I would imagine we're going to see, at the very least, the trend line continue. I don't think we're going to see any shrinkage from that. But we will know more on Monday. We'll see you then. And for those of you sticking around for the rest of the show, like to well, let's play a clip of this. Our next guest has a special that is playing. It is called the An Evening with Tim Heidecker, and it is actually Tim Heidecker who is the it's his comedy special. Here is a trailer for that. This debuts tonight. Let's see this.
My name is Tim Heidecker. I'm a comedian. Are you happy? Are we happy to be here tonight? I don't know what's going to happen. I really don't. It's a blank slate in front of me.
I'm Jake Nicholson.
Finally got a chance to hear the music of Keith Urban. I thought to myself, gee, this guy might want to change his name to Keith Rural. We broke some sprouts and this and that and turkey, not turkey, fat.
This is storytelling. This is Cosby comedy. This is, it's going to require a little bit of your attention.
You're like,
mama, mama, me, 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 mama, mama, me, 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 mama, mama, me, 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 me. Thank you. That's what you gotta do. That's what you gotta do.
Wow. All right. Well, let's bring to the show Tim Heidecker, who's whose Evening with Tim Heidecker debuts tonight. He's also the host of Office Hours Live. Tim, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Sam. I just want to give you a heads up. I am, just for archival purposes and verification purposes, I am live streaming this interview right now on my YouTube channel. So if there's any discrepancies or confusion or there's anything you want to end up doing later, we have the record. We are live streaming now. So say hi to everybody YouTube stream.
So, Tim, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, we have an exciting big premiere tonight. One of the great... one of my great stand-up specials. It's the first one, so hopefully it'll be the first of many, but we're premiering that tonight. Busy night for comedy with the Ali G movie coming out and everything, but you know.
Well, you know why you're doing, you know why you're feeling great is because this is how you're supposed to treat a guest when they come on a show. And that's, you're supposed to make them feel comfortable and welcome. And I only say this because I went on your show, and within seconds, I did not feel great. And
you're still crying about that?
Well, I'm not crying about it.
You're really upset. You seem like you're literally seething with rage about this. Like,
I'm sorry if I appeared to.
It was two minutes of your life that you came on my show, and I was happy to.
It was actually longer than 2 minutes.
Well, whatever it was, I was gracious enough to have you come on, and I thought we were going to have a spirited conversation about the state of journalism now. You dodged it left and right. You dodged it like I've never seen before, and you
wanted me to swear about Cuomo.
Yeah.
I guess the point is, I just wanted to show you this just to make you aware that you're feeling great, and that is because
you're I retract. I'm not feeling great, and you're not doing a good job. You're throwing me under the bus.
No, I'm not throwing you under the bus.
My audience is watching this. They're telling me, they're saying to me right now that you know, you're a bitter, spiteful, seething, angry guy who's trying to throw me under the bus. So whatever. I'm happy. I sleep well at night. I'm a happy guy, but not right now.
I'm sorry. I was just trying to point it out to you because I thought maybe since you've, you know, recently got into this game of, as we call it, of streaming on YouTube, that maybe you'd want to know, you know, how you can get guests to keep coming back on your show.
I had the President of the United States call into my show yesterday. On my show yesterday, I had the President of the United States call in.
You did.
And it was awesome. It was awesome.
You did. You had the President of the United States call in. You had Donald Trump call into your show.
I did. Look it up. It's right there on the stream. It was one of our biggest guests we've ever had, actually.
I would imagine that probably would be one of the biggest guests that you've had. Tim, so let me ask you this. Tell us about your special. I noticed you're not wearing a mask.
I mean, we shot it before the Wuhan flu hit our country.
So it's taken a long time for it to come out.
Yeah, it did take a long time for it to come out. You know, it's slice of life stuff, Sam. It's observational Cosby comedy. It's the stuff that I grew up on. You know, it sort of reminds me, I was sort of one of the few people sort of happy to have the virus come and shut down all the live venues. I don't know about you, but I was so relieved because, you know, every couple of years, I don't know if you've had this experience. You're a married man, correct?
No, not anymore.
Okay, fair enough. All right.
I mean, I'm pretty public, so.
Okay. But you were married and you understand the relationship. My wife, she would always say, oh boy, guess what? The Train, the band Train is coming to town, right? Remember the band Train?
No.
Pat Monahan, Train, they're a group in the 90s. You know, okay. Your audience, believe me, knows who they are.
You look that up.
Anyways, this is always a funny story to me. They say, she goes, you're going down and we're going to see them this Friday. We're going to see them. And she said, go down to Ticketmaster. So I'd go down there and I'd go up there. I'd say, we'd like two Train tickets. And they would say, what do you think this is, an Amtrak station? And that's where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
And Train.
That's good stuff.
What?
It's good stuff.
Thank you.
All right. So you,
what do you think we'll get out of the next debate, Sam? Were you guys talking about the debate? Do you think that there'll be any changes?
Tonight, Eric.
What's that?
It happened. I'm sorry. Did I call you Eric? I got confused because you did a show.
That's
right?
That's disrespectful.
The debate happened last night, Tim.
Yes, I know the debate. I'm talking about the next debate. The debate, assuming they're having another debate.
No, that was the last one. That was the last debate.
Oh, that's okay. I'm a little disappointed. Honestly, as an undecided voter, I'm still. I would like to hear like maybe one more, whatever it is, a half hour, maybe even another crack at the bat, so I can kind of absorb the message from the two of them, because I'm still kind of left with my hands up. I'm not really sure which way to go.
Who are you going to vote for?
No clue.
No clue.
I'm lost. I like them both a lot.
Right. You
know? Right. It's one of those, like, I might just kind of throw it, toss a coin.
Huh? Who'd you vote for in 2016? Ron Paul.
Yeah.
2016.
I think so. Yeah.
I think he ran in 2012.
The Libertarian.
Okay. Yeah. He didn't run in 2016.
I wrote him in. You're allowed to do that, by the way.
Now, why did you,
I'm a Libertarian. I'm a Libertarian. I believe in the freedom of speech.
Why don't you write him in this time?
I could, I might. But I like Joe. I like Joe Biden. I like his record, and I like Donald Trump. I think he's done a good job. So it's just tough. It's touring. I mean, I'm sure a lot of people.
Yeah, it's gonna be rough to still be weighing this out. And so you're special. Let's get back to that for just a moment, because I was looking at the thumbnail, and you're making all sorts of funny faces on it.
Thank you.
Kind of stuff that we can expect.
I mean, it's a lot of, we're kind of two insiders, you know. This isn't something I might say on Access Hollywood or, you know, Entertainment Tonight or something, but
have you been to those places?
I will be most likely doing some kind of junket at some point. I'll be doing the rounds.
Do it before the thing debuts?
Yeah, we were working on that, but because of conflicts on their side, there's sort of things are up in the air. Right. Listen, there's just a lot of balls in the air. But what I like to do, and this is kind of, like I said, it's kind of two pros talking here. There's a lot of filler in it in a way, because I use crowd work. I use a lot. There's a lot of music, waiting, like, you know, we kind of, there's a lot of filler in it, which is good, because filler is what often makes the best food, you know, the sort of.
Well, it also makes it a longer experience too, right?
Well, you have to fill out the hour, and it's not going to be me up there with a bunch of material, and content. It's time killing. And a lot of that is facial expressions, holding things, doing things over and over again, and, repetition. And also, you know, just focusing on my chunk, there's about 5 minutes of good stuff in the special. And, you know, that chunk has been so fine, you know, refined over the years. It's been so almost perfected that you're seeing the best version of a 5-minute chunk.
And do you disperse that 5 minutes of good material over the course of the 60 minutes?
Or? It exists in its chunk form in the 5 minutes sort of towards the end. Yeah. And then we have filler.
That's one of the things I think you read about where comedians, you know, will say, like, I'm trying to get a laugh every 30 seconds or I'm trying to get a laugh every 35 minutes or something like that. That seems more, you seem more along that pace, like at one joke.
You know, that's like a difference between a sprinter or a marathon runner. Like, I'm just looking to complete the marathon. The point is finishing it. The point is doing the hour, getting to the end of the hour. Do you follow me?
Yes.
It's not necessarily about the work I do within the hour. It's about getting to the finish line.
Except for marathons are actually graded based upon how quickly they get through them. And you're trying to run it as basically.
The optimal time for me, if this was a marathon, which I could probably do, it would be an hour. So it's a similar experience for me on the stand-up specials. We have an hour. Let's try to fill it best of my abilities. Get to that 5-minute chunk and then get the hell out of there.
Why did it have to be an hour? It's on YouTube. It's not like you're doing it on commercial television.
Well, HBO was in the market for this, and then they require an hour, and they backed out pretty early. But I had already committed to the paying the camera guys and everything for the time, so we just went through with it. But I would skip to the last 5 minutes. That's what's great about YouTube.
You can just scroll right through it.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that it is.
I mean, your show is for like 4 or 5 hours or something like that, right?
It's
got to be a lot of filler. Lot of
important stuff to talk about. Sometimes we have filler.
Every day there's something super important to talk about. Sure. I'm sure there's no filler.
Well, I think we're making the case that there's filler right now.
Okay, very good. Nice. That's nice. I love that. Bang. But believe me, I have you on tape right here. So, and I know what you're doing. You're cutting my mic and you're making me look like an idiot, but
we're live. Well,
my audience will be able to see exactly what's going on. Well, so there's no worries there.
You did mention that your special is being released on perhaps one of the most anticipated nights of the comedy, I would say, of comedy, probably at least this year, right? I mean, everybody is talking about Sacha Baron Cohen's premiere. And I honestly think this is probably the only time that somebody's talking about, not talking about it when talking about yours, like right now.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. Why is that?
Well, I mean, who did you not have people like think like, do you not have people who schedule these things or is it just sort of happen?
Excuse me. You know what? Let me show you something because you're wrong. And you're, as usual, you're wrong. I have an article here. Tim Heidecker announces, I'm bringing it up. Hudson Valley 360 is the website. HudsonValley360.com. Tim Heidecker announces the first ever stand-up comedy special in evening with Tim Heidecker premieres on October 23rd. Heidecker announces it first ever, and then it goes on. It tells the whole story behind it.
Valley.
So there's press.
Yes, that is. I think that's the from the Hudson Valley in New York, actually.
Yeah, that's a reputable source. There's another one here. Also, this is in my Google Alerts. This is also coming in from Hudson Valley 360. Same article. So they sent. They sent me that twice, Google alerts.
Anything about any of the farmers markets that are happening this weekend as well?
I'm just looking at my coverage. There's a side thing. Prattsville candidates call for leadership.
Yeah.
And Taconic driving school to reopen in-person classes. Those are the other big stories right now. So.
All right. Well,
you'll see some other footage. You'll see some other coverage throughout the day, believe me.
Okay. We got a question from the audience.
Oh, good.
Quinn from Indianapolis asked Tim why his pits sweat so much. Is he hiding something? How do folks gather that your pits sweat so much?
By seeing them. You know,
is that why you wear that t-shirt underneath there?
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, I try my best, but I perspirate. I'm a man. I have, a lot of testosterone surging through me, and it's, I don't urinate normally. I don't urinate like a normal man. Urinate on a like a 7 day period, every 7 days. So a lot of liquid is released in from my body through my armpits, and the doctors say it's perfectly normal.
That sounds. I mean, clotting through your armpits sounds normal. The other stuff doesn't sound that normal.
Because Sam, so you don't perspirate.
I mean, not no.
Because that shirt that you're wearing looks like it's ready to turn wet. Like it looks ready to turn wet. Like it could turn wet at any minute now. So we'll be watching that carefully.
I spilled something on it. It would. Let's just.
I want to have you on our show though again. I want to make it up to you. I'm gonna fly. I want to fly on a plane out to L.A. Put you up right here in the studio, the office hour studio. Will you accept or will you not?
Well, I would have to check my schedule and wait. I don't think I would want to go into it. I mean, I know what you're alluding to.
I think we get you on a flight. It'll be a Frontier is the airline I work with, or Alliance, who are awesome. And we get you. There are not a ton of flights out of the New York area, so we'd have to figure out when that would be. But I knew that I know they have a 6 a.m. flight out of Newark that can get you here for the next day. And
right.
And there isn't a show. If we did that on like a Wednesday, they have two flights a week. So we'd do that on a Monday and get you out here for the Tuesday show and get you back Thursday or Friday.
So we can talk about that. Maybe, you know, my people will look at my schedule and see about that. But I'm looking at your press release about your comedy special. And I just, you mentioned this earlier, Cosby comedy, right?
Nah.
You do. Cosby comedy. Is that like, give me a sense of what that means. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of what happened.
Prison for tax stuff or something. Was it tax stuff or I don't know.
It's more like a tax stuff, not
tax.
Right. Like, okay. I mean, he sexually assaulted women. He raped women is my understanding. Yeah.
Nasty stuff. And he's a bad guy, but he's a great comedy. He's a great comedy mentor, and you know he's not. I separate the art from the artist.
Did he actually mentor you?
In terms of have I watched the Cosby Show? Yes. Have I watched Bill Cosby himself? Have I watched Kodak Presents Bill Cosby?
But that's not mentoring. That's inspiring you, or maybe influencing you.
It's linguistics.
Yeah, I mean, it's what words mean.
Thank you.
I mean, that's sort of what you're doing, right? With your comedy special is you're trying to fashion words in such a way. So like the idea that people would have a common understanding of language is probably pretty important to what you do, right? Or no?
I like to think that there's a my freedom of speech is being attacked at this right now. And that's why I'm recording here live. My freedom of speech is I'm in a courtroom, the Sam Cedar courtroom, and I'm being judged by judge, jury, and executioner by you just because I mentioned that I liked one comedy guy who might've gotten himself in a little trouble, got himself in a little hot water. So this is the state of affairs right now. There's no way comedy cannot exist in this environment, and they're not letting comedians speak truth, and they are censoring. The censorship of comedians has never been we've never seen anything like it before, and I mean, shame on you for being a part of the mob.
Will you walk us through what that this censorship means? I mean, because we've talked about censorship in the past with comedians, it's like Lenny Bruce being arrested for saying some,
there you go,
words.
If Lenny Bruce was here today, believe me, he would not be allowed to say anything. He would have been so canceled by now.
What? Wait. Yeah, so this canceled is different from being arrested, right?
Right.
Right.
And he probably would have been arrested for some of the things he says.
Like who's been arrested for stuff?
I mean, you name it. Bill Cosby.
Bill Cosby was not arrested for for things that he did in terms of his comedy.
I understand that, but he could have been, though. I mean, he certainly is in that position. Look at who's another one? There's another one that got just recently. I'm blanking on
arrested.
A comedian got arrested for speaking honesty on stage. You got arrested, and a guy, we've never seen him again. He's off in underground somewhere. I don't know what's going on with that. I can't remember his name. Chris D'Elia, not him.
Have you in any way?
I don't remember, but whatever. There's a lot of them. A lot of comedy guys are getting arrested for saying what they think.
Let me ask you, give me an example of how you've been censored.
Well, I can give an exaggeration or an example, a hypothetical, if you want. I could give you like a, this is gonna happen if you want.
Well, that's okay. Let's start with that. That would be interesting to hear.
So let's say I do the train chunk, which I just did for you guys out there. And then Joe Biden and whatever her name is, Harris, says, well, you can't be making fun of Amtrak because Amtrak is a government, institute, a government agency. And we're going to, you know, then you say, if you say that joke on stage, you're going to jail. I mean, that's sick. That's spooky.
That's an interesting hypothetical, but let me see if I could add to that hypothetical. I am also a famous civil rights attorney, and I step in and do pro bono work for you, and I fight that.
Hey-o.
And you're fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could game out that way, but I don't know.
Or maybe aliens come from outer space and are able to put some type of protective cone around you so that even though they try and take you off the stage, they can't, because they run into an invisible force field that they can't penetrate. They don't know what it is because it's from the aliens.
Right. Well, yeah, it's pretty creative. And you get a lot of mileage on your show by being, you know, you've got producers in your ear telling you what to say and everything, and that's fine. But I'm by myself here, and
I'm totally by myself here.
No, that's pathetic.
It is.
It is pathetic, Sam. And you know, I have all sorts of people here. We're having a lot of good time, a lot of fun.
Well, this is really exciting for you.
I mean, it's hard because I'm always looking like, oh, should I say that? If I say this, if I say that, I'm going to get, you know, sent into Guantanamo. I'm going to sent down as a political prisoner. But I still do it because what else can I do except speak truth? And I'm a truth teller, and you'll see it all tonight. And maybe tonight's special will air, and that's the last you'll ever see of me, and I'll get taken out.
Do you mean by air? It's just gonna play on YouTube, right?
It's be just the way it's on Netflix. I say it's like a Netflix special. Same kind of cameras were used in the filming, and it's a lot of people think it's maybe a better special than it would have been if it was on Netflix. If it was on Netflix, it would have been canceled by now.
Was that video cameras? When you say the same kind of cameras, is that video?
They're Netflix cameras. They're the pro cameras. So.
Professional cameras.
There you go. And sound.
So is there a time that it's going to be on, or is it just sort of like show up whenever?
It's 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central time. So that it'll premiere then, and then it'll be there, and it'll be available to anybody with if you have a YouTube subscription or an account, they make it really easy. And aside from that, you have on YouTube all sorts of other things. You've got Jacques Pepin, the cooking guy, has a thing going on YouTube. And I think saw The Greatest American Hero. You remember The Greatest American Hero TV show? Old episodes of that are on. A lot of stuff on YouTube right now. It's actually a great venue, great platform for comedy and for entertainment.
Pretty hard to get your stuff on there, I guess.
In terms of upload, it's several hours for a high-quality upload, yeah. And it could fail. The upload could fail if you lose internet connection. There's a lot of obstacles along the way.
I would imagine fiber. You need a fiber connection. So,
anything else?
I think that's probably it. But I hope this has been, you know, a better experience for you than frankly I had on your show.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, what do you mean to send you, like a fruit basket? I'll send you a fruit basket, Sam. Well, I'll send you an edible arrangements. That's actually...
A lot of people actually do stuff like that when they want to say they're sorry.
Let me say, I'm so sorry that you had a bad time on my show.
Well, it wasn't just I had a bad time. I was given a hard time, and I didn't appreciate that. But okay. I understand this is
cry new, more.
New for you, and you're doing your best. So
cry more. Thanks,
keep
Sam.
Up the good work on that office hours live. So. Thank you, Tim Heidecker.
Steven Spielberg's calling, by the way, because it's an infringement of copyright, The Majority Report. There's already a movie called The Majority Report that he made with Tom Cruise. Look it up. You're in trouble. Big trouble, actually, and I'm going to be the one to push for that. Thanks, Sam. Good luck. Have a good weekend.
Philip K. Dick novel that it was about.
Goodbye. And bye, everybody.
Okay, and there you go. I see he's stolen my content, too. I'm sorry about that, folks. I'm sorry about that. I don't know.
Try to extend a peace offering and.
Yeah, that was. I was hoping that Tim would get it and understand how you're supposed to treat guests when they come on the show, but apparently he doesn't get it.
Real race to the bottom for the Tims and the Majority Report.
Totally. All right. Well, listen, we're going to go to the fun half, and we will, we're going to have those guys on from ManCard, right? Is it Lucas and Peter? Who are we going to have on from them?
That's right. Both of them.
Both of them are going to come on? Okay. All right. Well, let's take a quick break. And head into the fun half, and then we will talk to those guys. This is folks also on YouTube. I think it is right. ManCard. It is a documentary, and I don't know that much about it, to be honest with you. But Matthew Film Guy said it's worth us checking out, and that's all it takes for me. If Matthew Film Guy says it's good, then it's good. But it's an interesting film about. Essentially about, well, they'll tell us, but it has to do with the folks that Donald Trump appeals to. We got a lot of people IMing. I haven't even turned on the IM. I just that who are really put off by Tim Heidecker. And I can't say I totally blame them. That was pretty disturbing. All right, folks, just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show and you get extra content just about every single day. That's pretty good stuff. Also, don't forget, check out Nomi's show today at 3 p.m., the Nomi Key Show on YouTube, or you can find it on patreon.com. I don't know who's going to be on today. Also, don't forget, check out the Antifada. Jamie's got new content up at patreon.com/theAntifada. Matt, what's happening on TMBS this past week?
Oh, this weekend, Alicia Brooks is going to be talking to Drew Mikhail for patrons. So people should check that out at patreon.com/TMBS.
Great. And we will see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous? You're a little bit upset? You're riled up?
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-5014-57. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you. You fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.